Mom deserves the best, and there's no better place to shop for Mother's Day than Whole Foods Market. They're your destination for unbeatable savings, from premium gifts to show-stopping flowers and irresistible desserts. Start by saving 33% with Prime on all body care and candles. Then get a 15-stem bunch of tulips for just $9.99 each with Prime. Round out Mom's menu with festive rosé, irresistible berry chantilly cake, and more special treats. Come celebrate Mother's Day at Whole Foods Market.
Hey, I'm Ryan Reynolds. At Mint Mobile, we like to do the opposite of what Big Wireless does. They charge you a lot, we charge you a little. So naturally, when they announced they'd be raising their prices due to inflation, we decided to deflate our prices due to not hating you. That's right. We're cutting the price of Mint Unlimited from $30 a month to just $15 a month. Give it a try at mintmobile.com/switch.
$45 up front for 3 months plus taxes and fees. Promo rate for new customers for limited time. Unlimited more than 40 gigabytes per month slows. Full terms at mintmobile.com.
That's the second time it's gone off.
They never go home, those boys.
That's... Yeah. They have asked for that, really.
Well, you can laugh. It was the World Cup.
I'm a little bit of an idealist, but having said that, I want to be like me.
You don't know what you're talking about.
What did you know?
I managed to stay alive for 6 days.
I'd say it to your face, and I'll say it to you now.
I'm down to Anfield, and we'll see them, won't we?
What you doing down here, you shawny man?
I didn't go into the weekend expecting to be emotionally affected by the chief executive of one of Thailand's largest insurance companies celebrating the country's only goal in a 5-1 defeat to Sweden. But hey, it's World Cup time. Strange things are supposed to happen. Welcome to Monday Second Gams Football Podcast. Hi, Ken.
Owen, how are you?
Hi, Kieran.
Hello there, Owen.
But I'm all the better for seeing Thailand get on the score sheet. They were coming into this one off the back of that 13-0 defeat to the USA, and they were 4-0 down against the Swedes when their captain, Kanjana Sungun, drilled home their first goal of the tournament. So huge celebrations from the players, as you'd imagine. And then there was this tearful embrace on the sideline that people would have seen if they were watching, as the Thai coach was enveloped by a member of the backroom staff, who it turns out is more than just a member of the backroom staff. She's the general manager and main benefactor of the team, Nualphan Lamsam. According to a New York Times piece, her company not only sponsors the Women's League in the country, she also employs a lot of the players so they can focus on representing the national team. And so she focuses them through, employs them through the company when they can't play. Exactly, yeah.
Yep.
And allows them to, gives them the income and also the time to then worry about the football. And she led them around the pitch after the USA game. I think they all wanted to, you know, the ground to swallow them and all that kind of stuff. But she said, no, I have to go around, have to thank our fans. We have to hold our heads high. We're here at the World Cup and so on. So it's a nice moment for her. It's the first time I've probably talked about the chief executive of an insurance company on the show.
We've done a lot of episodes on. I wouldn't be so quick.
I would not be so quick if you look back. All right. As for their tormentors in the opening game, the much maligned USA. Well, I very much went into bat on behalf of the USA after
you did.
All the criticisms of their exuberant celebrations of those 13 goals. So
over the top of the ball is how I would describe your intervention on.
I guess I have to stick with them. You know, once this is the, you know, we're in the Twitter age, starting argument, you stick with that no matter what. So I'm going to have to praise their humour in how they dealt with the criticism in their second game when they celebrated their goals in a deliberately, some would say sarcastically, overly polite fashion, kind of.
No, it's great though, because
little golf style clap, little bits of applause to themselves, you know, to one in the eye for the critics who said they shouldn't have celebrated so much.
Of course, you know, and sarcasm is, you know, it's proven over the years to be the fastest way to win over the hearts and minds of people who may have doubted you in the past. Everyone loves sarcasm.
You,
right?
Like some others, Murph, are bugged by this USA team, but some of us.
Yeah.
Love their exuberance and love what they're all about. So we're going to talk about them and about some other World Cup matters with Rebecca Myers, who's covering the tournament for The Times. But first, some book club news.
And who wrote it?
I can't remember his name.
I'll tell you who wrote it.
Last Friday on The World Service, we brought you episode 3 of the I'll Tell You Who Wrote It Second Captain's Book Club, as Murph and I travelled to Belfast to listen to Joe Brodie talk about the life of Jolton Joe DiMaggio, an episode that took a little longer to come together than intended, but I'm glad you all enjoyed it. So let's not waste any time in announcing episode 4. Let's do it right now. In fact, it's one of the most famous football books ever written, The Miracle of Castel di Sangro. A brief synopsis. I won't even give you a synopsis. I'm just going to tell you Well, it is a synopsis, but it's very brief because it's about the American
a brief
writer.
Synopsis.
Yeah, I thought, you see, there are a lot of details in this book that will be spoilers if you haven't already read it.
Mm.
And I will say that when we actually do the book, we're going to have all those spoilers in the conversation. So if you want to get this read, do it before the piece. Mm. You can do it after, sure, but you will know about the various twists and turns and so on. So in brief, it is the American writer Joe McGinnis spending a season with this tiny Italian club who made it all the way to Serie B in the mid-90s. He finds a little bit more drama than he bargained for with regards to this miracle. It's great stuff. I won't go into too much detail, as I mentioned. As always, we've got the book ready to go for you with O'Mahony's Booksellers in Limerick. It'll cost around €13, which will include your 10% World Service discount. The same discount code applies as for previous books. I just realised I'm saying this on the Monday podcast, so I won't divulge the code right now. I'll
correct,
remind you of it again tomorrow.
You're following the procedures to the letter of the law here on, and I applaud you for it.
What I can tell you is that the person reviewing the book is, much like the author, an outsider who's had to fit into Italian life and get attuned to Italian sporting culture. It is the coach of the Italian national rugby team, Conor O'Shea, who has agreed to talk to us about this one. Looking forward to that. The books are available now on omahanis.ie. And we'll play the interview itself around this time next month. So middle of 3 or 4 weeks from now. So we'll give you a bit of time to get it and read it. But they are in stock, so you can order straight away. They should be a lot of fun. If you want to hear that, by the way, and are not a World Service member yet, you can sign up now on secondcaptains.com. Go back and listen to Dervla O'Rourke on Agassi, Damien Delaney on Only a Game by Dunphy, Joe Brolly on Joe DiMaggio, A Hero's Life by Richard Ben Kramer. And coming up next month, Conor O'Shea on The Miracle of Castel Di Sangro by Joe McGinnis. So the website is omahanis.ie if you do want to pick up a copy of the book. Now let's report on some sport, please, Ken.
Well, I guess we can start in Tokyo. We don't know if we'll do that. But let's go to Tokyo.
Insurance companies, Tokyo, all the lesser reported parts of society are getting their due here, Ken.
Well, let's go to Tokyo and speak to, and hear from, not speaking to, let's hear from Adidas athlete Paul Pogba.
So yeah, like you said, there's a lot of talking and a lot of thinking as well. I mean, you know, I've been here for 3 years in Manchester, you know, it's been doing great, and there's some good moments and some bad moments, like everybody, like everywhere else. But after this season, and after everything that happened this season, you know, with my season, when it was my best season as well, I think for me, it could be, can be a good time to have a new challenge somewhere else. I'm thinking of this, to have a new challenge somewhere else.
Yeah, sorry about the audio quality there from wherever we scraped that audio from. I need to get that microphone a little bit closer to Mr. Pogba. But yeah, so that's Pogba laying it out in fairly unambiguous terms.
Come and get me.
Yeah, so Manchester United have briefed that they fully expect Pogba to be starting the season with them in a couple of months' time. I don't think he will. I'm not sure when they say we expect to keep Pogba that they really mean that. It's more that they can't really say at this point, yeah, we're going to sell him probably at a good price now that everybody knows we're desperate. You know what I mean?
We're into bargaining territory, yes.
What do you make of the news there, Owen?
I am dumbfounded, Ken. Cannot believe that after his upturn in form in the early days of the Solskjaer regime, he has now chosen to leave the club. No, I'm not very surprised. Is anybody surprised?
No. What do you think they should do?
Sell him.
Yeah. What do you think?
Oh, yeah. I mean, yeah, sell him. Yeah. I mean, he doesn't want to play, and he's a disruptive influence in the team.
And was out of form by the end of the season.
Yeah. So, I mean, we wish you well.
You think he's a disruptive influence? I don't know.
Stop talking in the social media. Start playing.
Yeah, Skullsy.
I mean, that does give me a bit of a pain in the arse, to be honest, listening to Skulls.
But suddenly you find yourself coming back around to...
No, but he is. He's a disruptive influence... Partly what he does himself, but then also just like the disproportionate level of attention that he gets for even at his very best for Manchester United in the team that we've seen for the last few years. He's been a good solid player. You know, he hasn't been.
Oh well, no, at his very best in the first whatever, 8-9 games in the Solskjaer regime is ridiculous. It was goals and assists every literally every game.
Yeah, no,
so
I thought
at his best he was absolutely brilliant. But his best was only about a 8-week period, maybe.
Yeah,
max.
Yeah, there were a lot of penalties. Maybe, yeah, there was a lot of penalties.
7 or 8 penalties in the season just gone. Yeah, I mean, I think absolutely. So I mean, I think it's a problem for Manchester United to even if they were to try to keep him, which I don't think they will. They're going to be trying to get money for him. The question is, how much money can they actually get? At this point, the strange thing is that the obvious place where you would expect him to want to be going is Real Madrid. Mm-hmm. Because, you know, Zidane has praised him before and he's spoken about wanting to be there before. And who else could actually sign him? PSG, maybe. But, you know, PSG, again, have this kind of ongoing, how much can we spend really question with the fact that it's a lower level than he's been playing at, you know, all his career, you know, in terms of playing in league. Juventus, where he's already been. I mean, he goes from Manchester United to Juventus, Manchester United to Juventus, you know, and Juventus have just been taken over by Sarri. Yeah. Sarri, you know, Pogba is not really a Sarri type of player, I would say. I don't think he fits into that system where what Sarri wants is really... But Sarri would use a player like Herrera, who Manchester United have just let. He's now joined PSG, or will be joining them when the month comes to an end or whatever. You know, a player who will move the ball really quickly and be part of the system and run tirelessly. Whereas Pogba's kind of more, hey, let me shape the game here. Let me be the author of the game. Yeah. I think generally it's been a problem for Manchester United. This thing which has kind of developed over the last while of, you know, this guy's doing them a favor by playing for them. You know what I mean? It's like, it's totally the wrong kind of attitude. I think it gives a bad impression to the other players. You know, young players like Jesse Lingard, older than Pogba, who look up to him.
Yeah.
You know what I mean? It's nonsense. Like, Manchester United should still maintain the sort of self-respect to be a club, to think of themselves as a club where the players are excited to play for them, as opposed to this situation, which is, in Pogba's defense, this has been one of the worst transfers of a major player in the last 10 years, easily, in terms of how badly it's worked out for the player. His career has really just kind of run aground at this place.
Thankfully, he's had the World Cup. World Cup. I know, it's just, if that hadn't happened, it would just be a complete barren spell in his career.
Mm.
Whereas he's still young enough that he could be brilliant elsewhere.
Yes.
And, you know, at least it's not like this just gaping hole in his career. There is a nice World Cup win there,
yeah,
in which he was a brilliant player.
And I guess he's just like, this is not fun. You saw the scene at the end of the season where you had this fan giving it all the Paul's goals, only in much angrier and more vitriolic terms about, you know, Instagram and all this kind of stuff. Like, there's a real, you know, he's got to get out of there. He needs to save himself. And the question is, you then look at the team, you're like, we've lost a lot of good players. Like, I mean, are Pogba and Herrera the best two midfielders from last season? Arguably. Are they kind of, would they be, if everyone was available, sort of the first two players you pick in the midfield? Okay, not always the case with Solskjaer, although, you know, Herrera kind of dropped out of the team, partly due to injury, but also I think because of his contract situation, they realised he was going to be leaving. He had wanted to stay, but they didn't want to pay him the money that he wanted because they thought, you're a bit on the old side. And so when they realized he was going to leave, then he stopped being in the team. But that's kind of, okay, we've lost some of our mainstays here, including kind of a huge star in Pogba. What do you then do to, you know, who are they going to get? And I feel like they've been slow off the mark already in the transfer window. Given how bad a situation they had sort of got into and how they really need to sort of change things in terms of the the general perception of the direction that the club is.
How do you know
they've
been slow, though? I mean, they could be working on all sorts of deals.
Well, nothing has been announced. You know, they could have. What I mean, they have been slow because compare what's happened to Real Madrid. They've signed five players. They've signed five players for 300 million euros. Now, this is the other question mark that arises around Pogba is how do Real Madrid, seeming that they're interested in him, pay for him? I don't see how they can. The sort of money that United are talking about, he'd be more expensive than Eden Hazard. So how do you do that? I mean, you've got to obviously sell Gareth Bale, but who are you going to sell him to? You know?
Manchester United?
Well, there's, you know, I'm sure this will be offered. It's like, how about you take Gareth, you know? We see you signed a little Welsh guy.
Well, suddenly Man United are in
Daniel James.
Quite a strong bargaining position because I think they might have followed the various reports over the last few months that Gareth Bale is not wanted at Real Madrid. Well, so they will presumably take some sort of a cut price deal.
We'll take Bale if you continue to pay half his wages.
Yeah.
We'll take him, but you have to pay half. I mean, that would be, at that price, it would be worth signing Bale.
Bang, what would the transfer fee be?
Oh, zero.
Zero transfer fee, only have to pay half the wages. I would take that if I was Manchester United.
Yeah, that would be a good deal. I don't know if Real Madrid will agree to it.
I'd be surprised.
I don't know. But that, I mean, given the way that
they... Or we'll pay all his wages and you give us Raphael Varane. And now we're talking. Well, now we're talking. Yeah. Crack open a beer apiece. We've got some things to discuss now.
So hang on. It's Bale...
plus Varane for Pogba.
Oh, a swap.
Straight swap.
No cash.
None of that cash nonsense. Barter system.
I think they'd agree to that.
Well, I think Man United would take that.
The most famous club in the world. I'm not in Newcastle, a wee club in the northeast.
A wee club. God, he said so many insulting things that you forget. Was that in the same tirade that he told Pardew he forgets the help I gave him?
Simon is nodding, yes.
Yeah, I think it was the same. Wow. So look, yeah, we'll see what happens. The kind of deal that they'll be able to negotiate. But I mentioned Sarri, 2 million euros compensation goes to Chelsea. Is this I think it's the first time that's happened since Abramovich took over. They immediately will have to pay, it looks like, £4 million to sign Lampard again from Derby. This whole Lampard thing has just happened way faster than I expected. I mean, I fully expected it to happen, but I thought it might take another year. But no.
But it would have taken longer, I guess, if not for Sarri's. The way the whole Sarri thing's been phrased, it's like he wanted to leave. He wanted to go back. His parents are very elderly. Wants to work in Italy again. And in fairness, talk about a decent move for him.
Mm.
It's not as though he's taken a downward step here. It's great. Great stuff for... Congratulations, Maurizio Sarri. I feel quite sorry for him over the course of the season.
Sorry for Sarri. I don't feel sorry for him. I think he's had a pretty good season. Obviously, the Chelsea fans, some of them, disagree.
But that's what I mean. That's what the bit I feel sympathy around.
And they've got someone more in tune with their vibe.
Mm.
I mean, I read a piece, Jonathan Northcroft, I think, in the Sunday Times had written a piece about comparing, I don't know if you saw the 6-minute video of Jurgen Klopp going around hugging everybody after winning the Champions League. It was like just the camera sort of following Klopp's.
Gotta be honest, kind of couldn't watch it. I've just gotten to the point now where, sorry Liverpool fans, I've had enough Liverpool hashtag content.
Mm.
I'm done with the Champions League coverage.
What about all the Henderson content? I think it's his
No, I'm
today.
Ignoring it all now. Once it got past about a week after the Champions League final, I was like, Grant, enjoyed it, thought it was great, well deserved. Oh, jeez.
there was a...
That was a proportional response.
That's okay. That's from the semi-final anyway, I think. So I can still talk about that semi-final. That was incredible.
There was...
Okay, come on now.
BT Sport, I think, had a tweet that I saw earlier. It was like, Jordan Henderson celebrates his 29th birthday today. Told he couldn't run properly. Told he wasn't good enough. Told he was too safe. He's now a Champions League winning captain. Yeah. I mean...
Not all true?
If the reaction to that tweet was supposed to be, wow, Jordan Henderson, well done, I think BT Sport got that one wrong. That's all I'm saying.
Look, Jordan Henderson, congratulations. But they didn't win the Champions League because they had Jordan Henderson. You know what I mean? Like, he was...
A cog in the machine.
Yeah, I mean, once they find out where to put the cog, I mean, it took, you know,
the wrench,
it took nearly 4 years.
One of the cogs in the wheel is how I would describe Jordan Henderson.
Yeah,
cheap
yeah.
shot.
Once they took him out of the actual position of responsibility of running the midfield and allowed him to run at people and get in their faces, mm-hmm. then he did produce some better performances. Of course, he's now got to stay on that level. So next season should be his best yet. Where were we though, Owen?
Lampard.
Oh yeah, Lampard. So he's Harry Redknapp gets to go on TalkSport, relative, obviously, uncle to Frank. It will be a major surprise if he does not get the job, says Harry Redknapp. It's brilliant for him. A shame for Derby. He's gone up there and done a good job. I'm sure Derby loved having him there, the fans and everybody. So it will be a shame for them, the club, the fans. But for Chelsea, it's a great move for them. He is a genuine legend there. He is idolised. He knows the game. He knows what it's about. He has a touch of class, and I think he will be great. As I said, uncle to Frank. I think that's Frank Lampard prematurely celebrating promotion to the Premier League with still Championship Derby County after winning the semi-final of the playoff, or the playoff semi-final against Leeds. So that was a learning curve, I guess. Chelsea probably going to have the transfer ban upheld, it still seems. So that will mean it's kind of hard to see what he can do beyond promoting players, which Chelsea's the best club in the world, maybe with the exception of Juventus for doing this, given that they've got this massive player bank, you know, which they just loan out all over the place. Basically, they're making money off players, and now they might have to play some of these players.
Not be a bad thing.
No, absolutely not. But Abramovich supposedly has told Lampard, according to Duncan Castles anyway, that he will give him at least 2 transfer windows. Because Lampard supposedly was like, oh, you know, I mean, I love Roman. But at the same time, he is a little bit impatient. Is this really the best move for a young manager trying to make his way in the game? I mean, remember what Brendan Rodgers said when he was linked with this job years ago. I'm trying to build a career, not destroy it. Which I don't think went down too well at Chelsea. Like the notion that you, the Swansea manager, becoming the Chelsea manager would be
destroy your career
is not.
On the other hand, Brendan, they'll probably keep paying your wages for like 10 years after you get sacked. So
so he is a little concerned. He was supposedly a little concerned, but Abramovich just said, "No, I'll give you at least 2 transfer windows." And bearing in mind that we won't have any transfer windows for an entire year, that means 2 years to prove your mettle before I sack you. So it will be interesting to see how this works out. I mean, Lampard, I think, had done pretty well at Derby. You know, he could have done better, even better. But I suppose in terms of what Chelsea are looking for is as much somebody who will... I mean, they've had a manager who just had a good season. Like, if Lampard had that season next year with Chelsea, that would be brilliant. Now, of course, he won't have Eden Hazard, so, you know, that's... the team has clearly been hurt by that. But if he produced a season like Sarri has just done, he would be absolutely fated and idolised. You know, it would be... Wow, you know, this young genius, Frank Lampard, and he just gets it. He just gets the club. If he'd done literally every single thing Sarri had done.
Well, to be fair, though, would the Chelsea fans not be getting annoyed at the same 2 substitutions? Frank Lampard making the same 2 substitutions in every
game. If it was Lampard doing it, no way. Lampard.
I certainly think it would be less, but I do think they would still be getting a little annoyed.
Well, Lampard maybe would be a bit cuter.
Mm. What if he was unable?
He'd reverse the order of the substitutions, or he'd change it. You know, he's aware, acutely aware. I wonder, does he have a Google alert for himself, which is just really busy the whole time? Like, just his phone is just almost vibrating with these alerts. You know, as people say stuff about him on the internet, he is aware of criticism, as we heard, as we saw in the Derby dressing room after they beat Leeds. And he doesn't mind rubbing people's noses in it at the right time.
I think if he had lost his authority in the way that Maurizio Sarri did, if that incident had happened with Kepa Frank Lampard is. I suppose the point is, it wouldn't happen.
That wouldn't happen.
Kepa would have too much respect.
To be fair, if
for Frank Lampard,
Lampard wouldn't let. He couldn't let that happen.
So what would he do in that exact situation if his goalkeeper's refusing to come off?
It's interesting. In front of a stadium full of, in front of a Wembley stadium full of Chelsea fans, for Kepa to tell Lampard he wasn't.
You just don't see. You're not just taking that. You're not even entertaining the notion.
It couldn't happen. Like it could. It would. There would be a brawl. Lampard couldn't. He could not take that in front, you know, in front of all those Chelsea. There's no way.
I know, but you keep saying that. But like, what would he do? Physically remove him from
drag him off the field.
Do you think he would go on himself and drag him off or send some goons on to drag him off?
Goons.
Goons. Yeah. He wouldn't lower himself.
Oh, that's your answer for everything, kid.
Yeah, look, it is. It's hard to know. Yeah. But I just. Somebody like that.
Well, John Terry's going to be his assistant manager, so he probably would have got Terry.
Really should be. It's going to be Jody Morris, really should bring John Terry in. No disrespect to Jody Morris, also a very good Chelsea player.
No, because John, I'm not sure that John Terry enjoys quite the same favour at Chelsea. I'm not talking about the fans here. Oh. I'm talking more about the
working
hierarchy.
Up. Really?
Yeah. Mm. You know, because, I mean, they didn't have to let John Terry go. He didn't. It's not like he wanted to leave when he went to Aston Villa. But Chelsea were happy to say, thank you very much, John, and best of luck with the rest of your career. Remember that. I mean, and he went off to Villa to prove that he was still a top player. Chelsea could easily have kept him if they'd wanted, but they thought, no. They thought, well, let's fly, little bird. Let's see how you do, and all the best. So what else? Not really a huge amount. A lot of, you know, summer talk. Copa America, disgraceful crowds. You know, people were talking about some of the crowds at the Women's World Cup, which haven't been great. Some, like they've been very uneven. Some big crowds, some very small ones, but none quite so pathetic as the one in Belo Horizonte for Uruguay against Ecuador. I don't know if you saw that. It was like the Mineirao, the stadium where the 7-1 happened, almost completely empty, as Suarez and Cavani crushed Ecuador. But what was quite interesting about this round of the Cup, Argentina lost to Colombia, which was probably the biggest game. You know, they look exactly the same as they did in the World Cup. Messi just, you know, just this really dysfunctional dynamic. They could still easily get through this group, in the intergroup of Paraguay and Qatar. But the interesting thing was, I don't know if you saw Qatar's goal against Paraguay. It was a 2-2 draw between Paraguay and Qatar. Equaliser for Qatar was an unbelievable goal. Like, Ireland have not scored a goal remotely in this class. The last one I can think of that was anything like it in terms of the slickness of the build-up was Jason McAteer's goal against Holland in the Amsterdam Arena on September 2000.
I remember it well.
Like, so Qatar scored this kind of Xavi-type goal, where it was like bang, 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 lots of touches, lots of triangles, and eventually a ball into a through ball into the striker who slots it in. Goalkeeper nearly stopped it, but it was the kind of quality of this rapid fire build up, which was sort of like, hang on a second, like Qatar are quite good. I mean, they did win the Asian Cup recently, but I do wonder if they might be about to inflict on Argentina the most embarrassing yet.
Oh, it'd be too much, Messi. We talked to Tim Vickery last week on the World Service about why exactly Messi is A, still playing for Argentina, and B, playing this particular tournament. Because as Tim himself said, there's more prestige to next year's Copa America. There's a lot of messing around at the moment because they're changing to even number years. So you're getting Copa Americas in consecutive years. And most people are viewing
15, 16, 19 and 20.
Yeah, most people are viewing 20 is the big one. But Messi decided, and that's being played in Argentina, isn't it? But Messi decided that he wants to play this one, so clearly he feels this. There are still chances to win a tournament with this team, but apparently there's not, and now it looks like they're going to get knocked out by Qatar. Your prediction is anything to go by.
Owen, we all know that Argentina should still qualify from this group, and who knows, they could go on and win the whole bloody thing. However, seeing that goal made me realize there is a big, big chance of them getting knocked out by Qatar. I'm not saying it's going to happen, but I'm saying Qatar definitely can do it. They definitely can score against Argentina based on what they did against Paraguay. And, well, I'm not saying it's going to happen, Owen, but it could happen.
So he's almost like having a second captain in the team.
Second captain, first captain, whatever.
Richie Sadler's here. Richie, how are you?
How are you, lads?
How are you, lads?
Richie,
how are you, lads?
How are you doing this week?
I'm marvellous.
Look at the joy on my face. Look how happy I was. What the fuck happened? No, really. You know, what happened?
When John was young, everyone in the city knew about it, but no one had seen him.
It is not war and death and famine. It's not that at all. It's the opposite of that. It's persuaded there's a world outside of that. That's why sport's important.
Rebecca Myers is covering the Women's World Cup for the Sunday Times and joins us now from Nice. How are you doing, Rebecca?
Very good, thanks. How are you?
Pretty good, thanks. And I'm pretty interested in the American team. And I've talked about them quite a bit over the last week or so. They are scoring a lot of goals at this competition, but they're not necessarily making that many friends. Or is that a little bit unfair? Is the blowback to all the celebrating against Thailand a little bit overdone? Because I know you've spent a little bit of time around them and clearly they felt it. I mean, they heard all about the kind of criticisms they were getting.
Yeah, and it was certainly put to them in the press conference. Was it the right thing to do? And I think a lot of this bounces off them. I think we kind of almost can't underestimate how much it bounces off them. They're very much this super elite team who create an environment where they just don't engage in the outside world and they don't engage in the criticism, the comments of other people. Someone put Hope Solo's criticisms of Jill Ellis to Jill Ellis, and it just you could almost see it bouncing off her. They really don't engage with it at this stage in the tournament. I think also a lot of people here, especially fellow footballers, don't criticise that goal celebration in the way that we do, maybe as pundits and journalists and fans back home. If you're a competitive sports person, you know how much that means to someone and you know how important it is to celebrate. So really the criticisms are more coming from us, kind of the, you know, the lay people than really from the athletes themselves who I think see it and go, yeah, I would do the same.
Yeah, I have to say I didn't mind the celebrations against Thailand particularly. I thought it was legitimate enough to look happy after scoring goals in the World Cup. And I don't think it would have made any difference to the Thai players if they hadn't celebrated. They had their own disappointment to deal with there. But just in terms of the context that they go into this tournament, they have this court case against their own federation that's sort of ongoing at the moment, this legal case. Is that all wrapped up in it, do you think, that they're at this tournament now and they've created this sort of bubble that you talk about, and they seem to, for better or worse, they're going to do it their own way, essentially?
Absolutely. And however much they say, you know, this is a bubble and we're not thinking about the lawsuit on the field, in a way, how can you not be thinking about it in your spare time, I suppose, in your downtime between matches? They must know it's what everyone is talking about. It's also been such a big part of their past for years, really. This has been brewing for quite a long time, even though it's only been brought to this stage more recently. So it's a huge part of who they are and what they've been going through. And I think that is, like you said, why we saw these celebrations, is because pent up in that is all this, you know, like fighting they've had to do, all this anxiety and stress over their pay comes out in moments like that. So I think certainly as much as they are preserving this bubble and doing quite well on the pitch, it just that sort of glacial focus, actually, I'm sure off the pitch it strays into their thoughts every so often. They were tweeted by a senator, you know, after they won that match, saying this is proof that they should be paid properly. So they can't be totally unaware that that's going on.
Yeah, I mean, you used the phrase super elite regarding the kind of culture that surrounds their team or the sort of ethic that they've built up around the camp. And in one of your pieces, you mentioned that it struck you as quite different from, say, the I don't know, friendlier vibe that Phil Neville and the England team have sort of tried to create around themselves. Could you talk a bit about that that contrast? What struck you as different about the Americans' approach?
Yeah, I think, and obviously it's hard to say because you are looking in as an outsider, you're not with them day in, day out, but certainly from the England setup, I suppose what we saw, everyone saw that really powerful video of Frank Kirby sort of breaking down in tears at the end of the match because it was the anniversary of her mum's death, and Phil Neville sort of going over and putting, you know, a hand on each side of her head and just looking into her eyes and really talking to her. And it was a really beautiful moment. And that for me is summed up this sort of family atmosphere that they've created. I know it's a cliche and I know a lot of managers say it, but I really feel with Phil that there has been a connection with the players on quite a deep level, and they feel very much like a family. They're very chummy. They're playing sort of Mario Kart all day together when they're not training, and they laugh a lot. You know, they try to make Phil watch Love Island. You know, all of this kind of stuff. It's quite warm. Whereas the impression I've got from the US camp is not quite as relaxed and chilled out, I guess, because they have all that extra pressure. I quoted in my piece one of the players saying that, you know, you will fall down in this set up and people won't get up, and the people who get up are the people who stay in it. But that's a serious sign of how elite it is, and I don't know that you would hear that necessarily from the England squad. Phil does demand a lot of them. They are, you know, really pushed to their limits, but there's much more of a holistic approach to their well-being that I haven't seen from the American side. It feels a little bit more cutthroat. I heard Megan Rapinoe on a podcast saying, you know, we're intimate was the word that she used, but we're not close friends. I thought that was really interesting that you can be, in her words, intimate with someone. I suppose you've seen each other go through an awful lot, but you're not close friends. That is not an impression I get from the England squad at all.
Yeah. Well, you know, what's really fascinating about this American team is I can't think of too many other teams that are sort of under pressure from so many different angles, you know. Like, for instance, you quote Megan Rapinoe talking about the quote that you mentioned here from her is, what kind of person do you want to be for yourself, but also in the larger context of the country and in the world? As an athlete, my mission is to leave this game in a better place for the next generation, which is kind of like, you know, there's obviously a lot more than just the games that she's thinking about here or what they're doing there. I mean, as you mentioned, they can't, that, you know, they've arrived in France in the eye of a global gender storm. To what extent do you think they're sort of thinking about the wider impact of what they're doing besides everything that happens on the field? To what extent do these pressures affect what they do?
It's quite hard to tell. I mean, and Neville spoke about this in a press conference with a couple of us last week. He said that he thought the pressure to change the women's game in the UK and to, you know, change the world for an 11-year-old girl type thing was actually greater on them than the pressure to win the World Cup, which is a huge, huge thing to say. But obviously it's his job. It's the team's job. It's the team psychologist's job to make sure that when they stand on the pitch, they're not standing there going, oh my God, if I miss this goal, I've ruined it for a 10-year-old girl in Bolton or whatever. You know, it's part of the elite setup and the team psychiatrist to take that pressure off them, to remind them that they are players first and foremost, and football is their job. Again, I think, as we've said with the US, they obviously are managing to do that to an extent and managing to just put it all out of their minds when they're on the field. And every athlete knows about that laser focus they can manage. But you have to wonder, to what extent do they sit there in the evenings? Maybe does it occur to them? You quoted that Megan Rapinoe quote. She's obviously thought a lot about this. Maybe didn't look like how she thought it was going to look like when she said she wanted to be a professional football player. She probably didn't think that it would take this kind of extra battle, this extra, you know, dimension to her job. And now that she's realised it does, she's very resigned and very proactive about that. But you have to wonder if they realised, you know, as a young girl dreaming of doing this, this maybe wasn't necessarily what they all signed up for. But it is the reality of the game at the moment.
There's also this question of with the US team, how on the one hand they're praised quite a lot for standing up for the equality of women's sport and taking on their federation and all this sort of stuff. But then there's like another strand of criticism that, well, you know, actually they represent privilege. You know, these are like liberal white feminists who already have everything their own way. And, you know, I've seen, for instance, even Hope Solo, like one of the most famous former players, criticize the team for failing to represent America. You know, 18 of the 23 players are white. Hope Solo was saying, you know, there needs to be more representation here of women of color. It just struck me as a really odd situation for any team to have to deal with, in the sense of so many different agendas that have to be kind of catered to or satisfied or at least addressed. You know what I mean? I wonder, is there any of the kind of conversation around the US women's team, is this kind of stuff coming up?
Yeah, I mean, it's certainly, I think, a lot of this stuff gets pulled up in the American press, who obviously follow them very, very closely, which perhaps the British press wouldn't go into quite as much detail with. And the England team, for example, is highly representative. It's a really diverse team of girls from all backgrounds, in terms of income, you know, ethnicity, all of that. So I think we're quite lucky and we do really well in that respect. The US, obviously the hot topic for everybody at the moment is all of these things. It's Me Too, it's diversity, it's LGBT rights, it's you know, ethnic minorities. Everything is a really important thing for all sectors of society to consider at the moment. So it's not entirely surprising that it's reached all the way through to kind of, you know, the football and the representation there. It's interesting perhaps that, you know, as Hope said, I said it is a very white team. That's not really a problem we have in the UK. Like I said, it's very representative for us. But you know, you have to wonder if the cost of going into the women's game historically has been so great and it really has involved kind of scrimping and not earning a lot. Maybe what's happened in the US is that it has historically been families who can afford that, which has excluded some groups of society, in a way that perhaps it hasn't really in the UK. You sort of seem to find in the British scene, as it were, that everybody's had the same struggle and everybody's, you know, fought to be where they are. Whereas perhaps in the US it's worked that it's managed to kind of create a slightly more privileged pathway, if that makes sense, and exclude a few more people. But it's hard for us to say looking at them, because it's, like I said, it's not really a problem that we face, thankfully.
Like any World Cup, I guess, Rebecca, when you tune into the group stages, some of the games I've seen seem like brilliant occasions and really good games, and then some complete non-events. How's the country taking, you're back in Nice now for the England-Japan game later in the week. Does it depend on what part of the country you're in as regards the sort of interest in the tournament and how people are embracing it? Or is it more about whatever team happens to be there? Like, for example, the Netherlands looked great at the weekend, loads of fans, and some teams wouldn't have quite so many.
Yeah, it's a combination of both, really. It's some areas of the country are better than others. So Nice, for example, where we are, there really isn't a lot of publicity. You wouldn't necessarily know that there was a World Cup going on. Probably part of that stems from how strong the tourist industry is here anyway. They don't need the World Cup to boost their numbers, so there hasn't been loads of advertising. And obviously the England game in Nice last week was one of the most kind of poorly attended. It was about 13,000. Whereas in Valenciennes, where we're going, I think it's a bit more, we're hearing it's a bit better there. It's a smaller town. It does kind of need the publicity of the World Cup. The Netherlands, I mean, that was fantastic. And anyone who saw that on social media will have, you know, shared the joy that I shared watching that. But that was great for them because geographically it was really easy for them to attend. So I think around 10,000 fans came down from the Netherlands for that, because it was just so easy for them to get there. So that's just wonderful. So it there's a lot of factors in it. The French public are much less engaged with games that aren't their own. They're very, very, very active and engaged when it's their own team, and they've sold out every French game and they are coming in droves. I think it's, you know, 45,000, 55,000. But are they kind of coming along for, you know, our games? Not really. Our calculations show that there were very, very few fans for the England game who were French and were local. So I'm hoping as we go through the tournament that might pick up a bit more and the French might get a bit more engaged in teams that aren't their own, because that's what you want from a tournament. You know, you want people going along just to enjoy the football regardless of the nation, as well as the host nation themselves.
Absolutely. We'll listen, we'll leave it there. Rebecca, thanks a million.
Thanks so much.
I accept your challenge. I call out Ricky Roark and Steve Nash. Here we go.
Stop it.
That's one of those things.
Stop it. How many players can do this?
Duffman can never die.
He's 34 years old.
Robbie Keane continues to captivate.
It's one of those things.
Duffman can never die. Only the actors who play him.
No, he didn't. No, he didn't. Do you think Robbie Keane just said, you know what? Any questions about me being the MVP of this league? I think he just said right there.
Oh, yeah.
He's got more of a tan than me.
You said earlier, Ken, that Manchester United should still at least think like a club whose players are excited to play for them. It should still be an honour to play for Manchester United. Well, maybe they need to add Robbie Keane to their management setup then, because I see some quotes here from Robbie over the weekend with Neil O'Riordan in The Sun. I'll tell you, with Patrick Bamford, he should be chasing us. He should want to come here. If he doesn't want to, no problem. But we shouldn't be chasing people. That's what fucking winds me up. We shouldn't be chasing people. Why should we go and chase people? We are fucking Ireland.
says Middlesbrough assistant manager. You know, like, what's he on about?
Well, he says, yeah, we shouldn't be going chasing these lads. If you want to play for us, play for us. He's still coaching us.
Well, he's coaching mainly Middlesbrough now, Owen. I understand maybe the whatever his role was in the Ireland team maybe isn't that demanding and doesn't fill up that much of his headspace. But again, we've got this situation where someone who's supposedly working for us has gone to work for a championship club. I mean, Roy Keane already did it. It's not a crime, but like, it is a bit like. I mean, I'm not saying. I mean, who knows what Robbie Keane's doing? Like, what's his role? Playing football with the lads?
As assistant with Ireland, you mean?
Yeah. I mean.
Well, he's a good lad around the hotel. I mean, we've established that over years.
Yeah. Like, I guess he's someone that we can afford to have coming in on a part-time basis, getting photographs taken around the camp and all that kind of stuff. Mm. You know, it's not like we're going to lose much by the fact that he now has a full-time job with Middlesbrough. But, like, on the one hand, talking about how, we shouldn't be chasing people. People should be, you know, chasing us. And then, like, do you not...
Well, Patrick Bamford would also have two jobs. He would be the lead striker and the Republic of Ireland player.
Yeah.
It is international football. Like, nobody's trying to make up that assistant coach of an international football team is a full-time job.
Mm.
Come on.
Yeah, well, I love that one. That's good.
Well, I don't know. I mean, how much time do you spend thinking about the Ireland team between matches? Probably not that much, but you aren't paid to run the team. Mm. Is it too much to expect that the staff, that it's their main focus?
I mean, I do think some of our coaches should go to games. And not all of the Irish players are in the one division where you could watch them all on television.
Yeah. Well, Robbie, I think there's a point Robbie made that like he will be watching championship games, which will involve a lot of Ireland players. It's one of the advantages.
Two games a year.
Of him now working for Middlesbrough.
So just don't be injured if you're playing Middlesbrough, if you want a cap.
Well, no, but you'd be looking at scouting reports and stuff. You're going to be as well up on championship teams as you would be if you were in the stand watching games, I would say, if you're actually in the thick of it coaching, no?
Well, yeah, but there's also, you know, you don't just go to these games and go home again. I mean, I presume there's like an element
dossiers and reports.
But there's also like you walk up to the player that you've watched at the end of the game and say, I was here, well done, keep going, we'll be... I mean, I presume there's some level of interpersonal relationship between the coach who goes to the game and the player that they're watching.
Yeah.
I mean, maybe that's...
Like, you know, I mean, he talked about chasing players. That hasn't actually been our problem. Our problem has been players who play for us in youth teams not wanting to continue playing for us when they get a better option.
Players who we have successfully chased at 14 years of age, then running away.
Then they escape the enclosure.
Yeah.
And they run off to play for England because they, you know, so this has been our issue. It's not us chasing them, it's them running away from us. That's the thing we need to sort out.
Yeah, well.
So hopefully maybe the Middlesbrough assistant manager can help to make us a more enticing prospect to keep the ones that we've supposedly already got.
To use his own words, we are fucking Ireland. Thanks, Ken.
Thanks, Owen.
Thanks, Murph.
Thank you, Owen.
Thanks, Ken.
Thanks for listening.
That's the second time it's gone off.
They never go home. They never go home. They never go home, those boys.
Mom deserves the best, and there's no better place to shop for Mother's Day than Whole Foods Market. They're your destination for unbeatable savings, from premium gifts to show-stopping flowers and irresistible desserts. Start by saving 33% with Prime on all body care and candles. Then get a 15-stem bunch of tulips for just $9.99 each with Prime. Round out Mom's menu with festive rosé, irresistible berry chantilly cake, and more special treats. Come celebrate Mother's Day at Whole Foods Market. Mom deserves the best, and there's no better place to shop for Mother's Day than Whole Foods Market. They're your destination for unbeatable savings, from premium gifts to show-stopping flowers and irresistible desserts. Start by saving 33% with Prime on all body care and candles. Then get a 15-stem bunch of tulips for just $9.99 each with Prime. Round out Mom's menu with festive rosé, irresistible berry chantilly cake, and more special treats. Come celebrate Mother's Day at Whole Foods Market.